It is Thursday, July 9th. If you feel like the ground is shifting under both your portfolio and your screen time, you aren't imagining it. Hyperscalers are currently on track to spend $5 trillion on artificial intelligence infrastructure by 2030. Meanwhile, data center growth has slowed from doubling annually to roughly 15%. The math here is starting to look shaky. These companies already generate $1.5 trillion in revenue. The expectation that they can add another $3 to $4 trillion, a figure that exceeds 10% of total United States gross domestic product, seems to ignore the practical limits of how much money one sector can actually pull in. The market is currently pricing in 31% annualized earnings growth. That projection assumes the massive spending seen in the first quarter of this year will continue unabated through 2027. If those earnings don't materialize, we are looking at a sharp correction. It is a hell of a gamble to bet that this spending spree will keep the equity market afloat indefinitely. Look at how the players are reacting to this pressure. Meta is trying to vertically integrate by building its own chips with Broadcom and Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company, hoping to cut out the middleman and lower their compute costs. It's a classic move to protect margins, but it's expensive. They are essentially betting that in-house silicon will eventually allow them to move high-end NVIDIA and AMD hardware to only the most complex tasks. It's a massive capital burden. We've seen Meta burn money on secondary ventures like the Metaverse before, and it didn't exactly pay off for shareholders. This time, they are playing with their core advertising profitability, which creates a very real tension between their cash-generating business and these speculative infrastructure bets. Meanwhile, companies like GE Vernova are playing the other side of the trade. They aren't betting on the software. They're betting on the fact that these data centers need an absurd amount of power. They have a $163 billion backlog for power generation equipment. It's a safer play in the sense that it's physical infrastructure, but it's still tied to the assumption that this demand isn't just a cyclical spike that could evaporate if the hyperscalers pull back on their spending. Then you have the memory chip manufacturers. Companies like Micron are boosting capital expenditure to $250 billion to re-onshore capacity. The goal is to move away from the traditional boom and bust cycle of the semiconductor industry towards sustained growth. But if they oversupply the market with high-bandwidth memory before 2028, we're going to see a correction that will make those current stock valuations look pretty optimistic. There is also a growing disconnect between the federal-level excitement about artificial intelligence and the reality on the ground. Local communities are increasingly hostile toward the physical footprint of these data centers, citing utility costs and environmental impacts. If local opposition continues to block construction, or if geopolitical instability spikes oil prices and messes with the Federal Reserve's liquidity, this whole investment cycle hits a wall. It is worth noting that while the tech sector focuses on this high-stakes capital allocation, the labor market is becoming weirdly stagnant. Headline unemployment is low at 4.2%, but the market has become incredibly still. There is low churn and high barriers to entry for younger workers. Opportunities for recent graduates are at their lowest level in a decade, excluding the pandemic. We are essentially creating a generation of workers who are locked in place. If the economy isn't providing the entry-level roles that teach basic professional norms, we are looking at a long-term erosion of skills. It's a strange paradox. We are rushing to build the most advanced infrastructure in human history, while the labor market is losing the basic dynamism it needs to actually function. The takeaway is that we are prioritizing short-term metrics, like earnings expectations and low headline unemployment, while ignoring the structural fragility underneath. Whether it's the massive capital outlays for compute or the way we're managing labor, the current stability feels like it's masking a lot of underlying risk. It's not just about whether the tech works. It's about whether the system can actually handle the speed of this transition without breaking something fundamental along the way. That kind of massive spending assumes a future that is still being built. But if the tech is changing, we have to change how we use it. The latest release cycle for AI models has finally hit a wall of diminishing returns for benchmark chasing. OpenAI, Anthropic, and xAI have all dropped new iterations, including GPT-4o, Grok 3, and o3. These systems are moving away from the static, text-based chat interfaces of the last 2 years. They are now being architected as persistent, multimodal partners that handle continuous voice interaction and execute delegated tasks in the background. The industry is effectively splitting its stack. High-end frontier models are being reserved for complex, strategic reasoning tasks. Meanwhile, specialized, cost-effective models are taking over the high-volume, tool-heavy execution work. This is a direct shift from treating AI as a shiny novelty to treating it as a piece of infrastructure. Here's the thing. The marketing hype is starting to look a little desperate. OpenAI recently audited its own SWEbench Pro metric and found that 30% of the tasks were flawed. That's a hell of a thing to admit while trying to sell a product. It confirms what anyone actually trying to build with these things already knew. Chasing the highest benchmark score is a fool's errand when the metrics themselves are held together by duct tape. The real shift isn't in which model has the highest intelligence score. It's in the genie-steering model of work. We're moving into a phase where the most valuable skill is no longer prompt engineering, but project management. You aren't writing code anymore. You are acting as the architect for a system that handles, routes, and maintains your workflows. We're seeing three clear patterns emerge for how this actually gets built. There are feeds, which turn chaotic Slack messages and meeting notes into clear task cards. There are routers, which automatically delegate incoming emails to the right agent. And there are heartbeats, which are just automated, recurring processes that keep the system updated over time. It's not magic, it's plumbing. The friction, however, is real. Some models are so obsessed with internal validation and strict technical linting that they become uselessly rigid. They'll stop a project dead in its tracks because they don't like the architectural rules they've been programmed to follow. On the other hand, newer models are leaning into being messy, practical partners. They prioritize getting the job done over being technically perfect. It's the difference between a coworker who actually wants to finish the project and one who just wants to cite the handbook. If you're still model hopping, jumping to the latest release every single week, you're losing ground. The competitive advantage today belongs to the teams that build stable, proprietary operational harnesses around existing agents. You identify one repetitive bottleneck, you apply automation to that specific point, and you let the system compound from there. The pirate phase of AI is over. You know the type, the person who uses these tools to throw together a prototype in an afternoon and thinks they've changed the world. That's fine for exploration, but it's a terrible way to run a business. The architect phase is where the actual value is hiding. It's about maintenance, feedback loops, and building software that's designed to be operated by an agent. It's a boring, unsexy, and deeply effective way to work. The companies moving toward this are going to be in a very different position than the ones still waiting for the next, smarter model to solve their problems. The tools we have right now are already more than capable enough to handle most of what we throw at them. The problem isn't the model's intelligence. It's our inability to stop treating them like chatbots and start treating them like employees we need to manage. If you're waiting for the next big leap to fix your broken workflows, you're missing the point. The leap happened. You just haven't built the infrastructure to catch it yet. Managing those tools like employees is one thing, but managing a team on the field is another. The same obsession with efficiency is rewriting the rules of sports. France is currently playing at a high level in international competition by rendering traditional defensive metrics obsolete. Their attackers are dismantling opponents, effectively forcing other teams to choose between overcommitting on defense or surrendering control of the match. It turns out that when players like Kylian Mbappé, pronounced Kylian Mbappé, and Ousmane Dembélé, pronounced Ousmane Dembélé, can generate power from almost no space, expected goals models simply stop mattering. Opponents are left with a shitty choice: step forward and get dribbled past, or drop back and get picked apart. That's a hell of a position to be in for 90 minutes. This isn't just about raw talent. It's about how that talent forces everyone else to play a perfect, high-stakes game where even a 10% shift in intensity from France ruins your entire defensive plan. Even teams like Morocco, which have built a stable, competitive program by tapping into French and Spanish youth development systems, are still hitting a ceiling. You can build a smart, efficient pipeline, but eventually, you run into a team that has elite, world-class talent at every single position. At that point, you're just hoping for tournament luck. We're seeing a similar tension in horse racing, where tracks like Oaklawn Park are aggressively moving their prep races to get a competitive edge. They moved the Arkansas Derby to 3 weeks before the Kentucky Derby to attract top horses, hoping to secure that 100-point qualifying status. It's a direct move to control how the sport's elite horses are trained. Or at least, that's the goal. Trainers now have to decide if they want to push for a peak performance or just hunt for points. And that uncertainty is creating a massive disconnect between the industry's historical traditions and its current economic reality. The problem is that the sport is stuck with a fragmented calendar. While shortening the window might make sense for a single track's bottom line, it creates a real mess for the horses. You have organizations like the Preakness sticking to an outdated timeline, while regional tracks are essentially running experiments to see who can grab the most influence. It's a classic case of institutional inertia fighting against basic logic. If the industry doesn't consolidate into a more rational prep circuit, we're going to keep seeing these erratic, high-friction shifts that hurt everyone involved. Meanwhile, in the NBA, teams are treating the second apron as an absolute, hard limit rather than just a tax. It's changing how front offices approach roster building, and it's getting ugly. Teams are choosing to dump key role players just to stay under the limit, which leaves them relying on average replacements when the playoffs roll around. Regarding the Knicks, the organization has faced significant roster pressure due to the new collective bargaining agreement, forcing difficult decisions regarding player retention to manage the salary cap. It's a race to the bottom, where chasing financial flexibility is actively destroying team depth. Then you have the Arizona Cardinals, who are basically punting on the upcoming season to chase a high draft pick. They've committed to a run-heavy philosophy that seems designed to hide their lack of depth. Betting markets aren't buying it, setting their win total at a measly 3.5 games. It's a calculated, depressing effort to reset the organization. And honestly, it's an avoid scenario for anyone who actually likes watching competitive football. The common thread here is that we're watching a shift from emotional, fan-driven decision-making to cold, systemic management. Whether it's the MLS prioritizing long-term academies or the NBA front offices obsessing over the second apron, the goal is stability. The issue is that the public doesn't see the math. When a team trades a favorite player or changes a schedule, fans see a disaster, but the front office sees a necessary, data-backed move to keep the ship afloat. It's a brutal trade-off. We're losing the chaos and the what-if factor that makes sports fun, and we're replacing it with a series of optimizations. Success, at least in today's landscape, isn't about the individual genius of a coach or a player anymore. It's about organizational discipline. It's about who can manage the boring, invisible constraints better than the guy in the next office over. It's smart, it's stable, and it's, quite frankly, a little bit sterile. It is a sterile way to win, which feels worlds away from the messy reality of the media landscape. Everyone is scrambling to find something that feels real. The New York Times recently announced a significant internal restructuring to prioritize video content production. They are making this pivot to survive in an attention economy dominated by social media aggregators and algorithmic feeds. They are effectively trying to maintain their long-standing editorial standards while competing against creators who rely on the fast, casual, and often unrefined video styles that dominate the internet. It is a high-stakes bet that they can remain relevant without sacrificing their reputation for accuracy. Meanwhile, in the private sector, founders are moving in the exact opposite direction. The current trend in business marketing is to abandon the high-production, polished corporate aesthetic in favor of raw, unfiltered documentation of the work itself. The logic here is simple. People do not trust logos anymore. They trust people who show their work and talk like human beings. This creates a weird, uncomfortable tension between how we used to build power and how we do it now. Traditional institutions, whether it is a major newspaper or a massive corporation, are trapped by their own scale. They are obsessed with professionalized systems and rigid branding because that is how you look important. But that same obsession is exactly what makes them feel fake to a modern audience. It is a hell of a thing to watch. You have legacy institutions scrambling to look more like the kids on TikTok, while the kids on TikTok are building real, high-value businesses by acting like they have nothing to hide. The problem for the big guys is that they cannot easily pivot to authentic communication without blowing up their own sense of authority. If a massive, century-old institution suddenly starts acting like a scrappy YouTuber, they risk losing the very thing that made them a pillar in the first place. You can see this loss of trust in the public sphere, too. When the information flow is controlled by spin, the public does not get clarity. They get plausible deniability. This breakdown of transparency is happening in smaller ways, too. Look at youth sports. We have traded the old, low-stakes community model for a high-cost, high-intensity pipeline that treats kids like commodities. We are professionalizing childhood, just like we are professionalizing the newsroom. We are trading away the messy, spontaneous, and informal parts of life for systems that prioritize scale and speed at every single turn. And honestly, the cost of that trade is pretty high. When you look at content creation, the same dynamic is at play. The most memorable, high-impact conversations are the ones that ignore the script. When a host relies on pre-planned talking points, the ability to actually listen disappears. It becomes a performance instead of a connection. But corporate executives hate that kind of spontaneity. They want safety. They want a format that has been focus grouped into oblivion, because it is easier to sell something that looks like what we have already seen. The irony is that the most successful people right now are the ones who have the guts to bypass that oversight. They are choosing to be peers rather than polished service providers. They are betting that being a human is worth more than being a brand. It is a risky path. It requires the ability to function when you are struggling, and it requires the confidence to ignore the pressure to scale for the sake of scale. But when you look at the landscape, the people who are winning are the ones who are scaling depth instead of breadth. Traditional institutions are trying to survive by becoming more like machines. The individuals who are actually capturing attention are doing it by becoming more like, well, people. It turns out that when you remove the intermediaries and stop worrying about looking professional, you end up with something that actually matters. It is not always pretty. It is not always polished. But it is real, and right now, that is the only asset that actually holds up. Authenticity is hard to fake, unlike some of the technical problems we run into daily. Here is what else you should be tracking tonight. A few other things worth knowing. Perimenopause messes with how your muscles actually work, specifically the connection between actin and myosin proteins. You lose power and grip strength long before you see it on the scale, so maybe stop skipping the heavy weights. In Thailand, a briefcase is called a Kapow James Bond, pronounced Kapow James Bond. It is a perfect example of how pop culture just moves in and names things when a language does not already have a word for the job. Some entrepreneurs are using interest-free credit card cycles to fund real estate or marketing bets. It works until it doesn't, which is a hell of a way to run a business. Systematic investing, where you let data handle the growth and momentum picks, consistently beats human analysts. It turns out that removing the human element from your portfolio is actually a pretty good strategy. The American political system is basically a gerontocracy because the rules are rigged for incumbents to stay forever. Seniority and committee control are great for the people in power, but they are pretty shitty for the rest of us. The recent attempt at a ceasefire between the United States and Iran failed because they are after fundamentally different things. Iran wants the Strait of Hormuz to keep its leverage, and they are not exactly looking for a handshake. Turning old office buildings into apartments sounds smart until you look at the floor plans. Most offices are too deep to get windows into every room, which is a bit of a deal breaker for a bedroom. Maine election laws allow a 500-person convention to replace a primary candidate. It effectively cancels out the 200,000 people who voted in the first place, which is a hell of a thing to call democracy. Stop looking at daily active users and start looking at dot plots. Mapping specific user events reveals the actual value in your product that big, messy averages usually hide. A single-time synchronization error took down the entire Telstra network in Australia. It is a stark reminder that when you centralize your infrastructure, you are just building a very expensive house of cards. Insurance companies are trying to turn themselves into lifestyle car clubs to gather more data. If they can track your driving habits through an app, they can price your risk with terrifying accuracy. Pope Leo XIV recently issued a formal decree of excommunication against the Society of St. Pius X, citing unauthorized bishop ordinations. It is a blunt way to make sure the Vatican stays the only game in town. If you are running ZFS storage, stop building rigid pools and start using modular VDEVs, pronounced VEEDEVs. It balances your data across every drive and stops you from hitting artificial capacity walls that you will eventually regret. That is the wrap for tonight. Get some sleep, and I will see you back here tomorrow.